We're talking about speech on college campuses and First Amendment rights. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A federal judge ruled Friday that Northeast Wisconsin Technical College violated a student's First Amendment rights after she was told to stop handing out Valentines with Bible verses on campus last year. So we're exploring this case against this backdrop of lawmakers across the country passing bills that aim to protect free speech. At least 8 states now have enacted free speech laws this year, Texas, Alabama to the most recent. So what's your opinion on free speech zones, these designated areas for public discourse? How should campuses moderate speech? Do you think we're more sensitive than we used to be? What examples do you have? 800-642-1234 is where we're at. Howard Schwaber is a political science professor at UW-Madison. He's written several books, including one on the First Amendment. Howard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, glad to be here.
Well, take us to the situation at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College in Green Bay, where we're looking at First Amendment rights around Valentine cards. Help us understand what happened here.
Well, I don't have detailed knowledge of what the university was thinking. It seems like a kind of an open and shut case, honestly. Private individuals are free to express themselves as they like, unless there's a regulation, a neutral regulation about time, place, and manner in place. So what apparently happened here is that a university authority of some kind took it upon themselves to decide that one kind of speech was okay and another kind was not, and that's simply never acceptable. The name for that particular action by a government agency is viewpoint discrimination, and the First Amendment almost essentially never permits the government to discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. So you could have a rule that says no one can hand out anything to anybody in a certain area, but you certainly could not have a rule that says private individuals cannot hand out materials that have religious themes.
Well, do you think that there was this mistake, perhaps, in thinking because there was this religious overtone, this was religious messaging, and that was complicating the situation?
Oh, I'm sure that's right, and it speaks to the fact that in many instances, college administrators and college security officials don't have a good understanding of First Amendment principles. So what I suspect was going on is that someone at the college said, oh my gosh, if we allow a student to hand out materials with religious messages, we will be participants in promoting a religious message, and that might violate the Establishment Clause. Now, that's completely wrong. Where a private speaker is voluntarily engaging expression, you know, the Establishment Clause is simply not in play. But it is possible that some of the universities simply didn't understand that. And as I said before, that speaks to the need to improve public understanding of what the First Amendment does and does not require.
Well, the president of the college has said that part of the issue was the location of the students' actions. What are we seeing with location and free speech on campuses?
Right, so that raises a different set of issues. And it's important to point out, as the president's comment suggests, each case depends on a complicated series of facts. I should not jump to assuming I know what was going on, what the right answer is, without a very detailed knowledge of what the particular facts were. So the issue of location is complicated. In the first place, under the First Amendment, we recognize different kinds of locations. The term is forums. So in a public area, like a park or a sidewalk, the government has the least authority to regulate speech. The more an area is not public, say the inside of a classroom or the inside of a professor's office, the more we're of an area that is not a traditional public area where people gather and express themselves, the more authority the government has. And so what some colleges and political campaigns and cities have done is try to designate free speech zones. They've said, okay, only this area is covered by the free speech guarantees, and the rest of these areas are not. We're going to declare them non-public areas. These are very, very troubling moves. They haven't really been thoroughly tested in the courts. The Supreme Court has never issued a clear ruling about when or whether this idea of free speech zones is acceptable. Certainly on a college campus, to try and declare that some public areas are free speech zones and some public areas are not, almost certainly violates the First Amendment, and at a bare minimum, violates the spirit and the idea of free exchange and free expression.
We're talking about protected speech and the climate for speech on college campuses. Howard Schwaber is a political science professor at UW-Madison, and he researches First Amendment rights. You can join in. Do you think it's good that we're less tolerant of offensive speech? In what ways do you see the First Amendment being challenged? Join in with your thoughts on speech on college campuses, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Howard, do you think colleges today are pushing the boundaries of free speech rights? What do you see out there?
In some instances, certainly. It's a really complicated issue, and it's made messier by an intrusion of partisan politics, which one side or the other tries to claim that the free speech mantle and accuse the other of being the one at fault, which is not helpful. So we have, for example, a series of issues surrounding Title IX. That's one set of issues, and harassment, hostile environments. We have a series of issues involving student actions to prevent speakers from being heard or prevent the university from entertaining certain kinds of visitors, and that's one set of issues. And then we have the issue of the actions of university administrators. Actually, there's a fourth category, which is the actions of alumni and legislators trying to force colleges not to allow free speech, often in the name of free speech bills. Some of these bills are, in fact, better described as speech-chilling bills. So it's very, very hard to give a simple description. I don't think it's the case that there's really vastly more suppression of speech now than there's been historically. Colleges have always been places where rambunctious young people try to express themselves in ways that authorities disapproved of, and colleges do not have a sterling record of allowing whatever kind of speech it is that they disapprove of to taking place. It's worth remembering that the radical movements that started in Berkeley in the 1960s were initially as much about demands for free speech rights as they were about opposition to the Vietnam War. Today we see organized efforts and unorganized efforts to try and prevent unwelcome voices from being heard, coming from both the right and the left. It's interesting that the organizations that track disinvited speakers, for example, the phenomenon of speakers who have been invited being told, no, don't come here, those organizations find that those disinvitations come more often from the political right than from the political left, even though we tend to assume colleges are largely more liberal than conservative. I mentioned that fact, though, just because it tends to surprise people and emphasizes the extent to which this issue does not map neatly onto partisan questions. We have conservative legislators, conservative alumni, passing laws to prevent anti-Israel speech, for example, or to defund programs of which people disapprove, or to deny tenure to scholars who are outspoken, or deny hiring to scholars who are outspoken in one way or another. We have, on the opposite political end of the spectrum, students organizing to prevent certain speakers from being heard because they're viewed as insufficiently liberal or insufficiently progressive. And we have a relatively new phenomenon, which is the professional provocateur. People who are invited to campus for the sole purpose of trying to stir up as much trouble as possible.
How has that gone?
Well, not well for universities. The obvious example is Milo Yiannopoulos, and his infamous visit to Berkeley cost Berkeley $500,000. That's a significant strain on a university's budget. You could, in theory, drive a university out of business by repeatedly pulling stunts like that. And it points to the fact that our traditional First Amendment categories aren't really well designed to deal with all the different ways people have found to weaponize free speech rights.
We're talking about First Amendment rights and protected speech on college campuses. Talking with UW-Madison political scientist Howard Schwaber. He's our guide. We're also looking at legislation and recent court challenges in Wisconsin and this ripple effect around the country on campuses. Do you think it's good that we're less tolerant of offensive speech? In what ways do you see the First Amendment being challenged? What do you think? Are we more sensitive today? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on free speech issues on college campuses. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. Republican lawmakers reintroduced a bill last month that would punish students who interfere with campus speeches and presentations with suspension and expulsion. And the state assembly passed a bill last session that would suspend UW system students twice accused of disrupting others' free speech. That died in the Senate, but UW Regents had adopted the sanctions as policy in 2017. Connor Mathias is vice president of the UW-Milwaukee Student Association.
You know, at this point, I just think it's an unnecessary overstep by the state legislature when we have great administrations, great dean of students offices on campus that are can deal with this by themselves.
So your thoughts here, should lawmakers put laws on the books setting disciplinary rules for speech on campuses? Is this overreach or in line with legislating? What's your opinion on free speech zones? Join in at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison political scientist Howard Schwaber stays with us. Howard, as we look at student protests of certain speakers, extreme speakers, what have campuses done by way of bringing equal time to speech?
Well, I mean, that question presupposes a notion that campuses ought to give equal time to all possible views, and that's simply not true. In fact, the whole idea of a college, in part, is to exclude ideas or exclude voices as well as to include them. In Wisconsin, we like the phrase sifting and winnowing. There's no point to sifting if you don't winnow. So, for example, there's no obligation for colleges to present a speaker who says the Earth is flat. There's no obligation for a biology department to entertain lecturers who want to say that evolution is wrongheaded and to preach creationism. Right? On any of the areas in which university departments are expected to have expertise, we demand of them that they act as gatekeepers and help define what is and is not a respectable argument. What happens when that same idea is extended to political positions? And that becomes a difficult issue. But it's important to note, no one has a right to speak at a college campus. There's no First Amendment right to be an invited speaker. And the principle of free exchange of ideas doesn't mean that the university has to provide a platform for all ideas or all voices. What it does mean is that the university can't suppress voices in traditional public forums. And if the university has a system for, let's say, inviting speakers, that system has to operate in a neutral way. So, for example, if the university allows student organizations to invite speakers onto campus, universities don't have to do that, but if they choose to do that, then those rules have to apply equally and neutrally for all student organizations. Mm. By contrast, if the university is inviting speakers, there's no obligation whatsoever. In fact, the university is encouraged to do the opposite of providing a platform for all voices, to choose the most distinguished, most exemplary voices and present what the university think are the very best answers and attitudes. And that means a Catholic university can invite only Catholic speakers. And it means that a university with a STEM focus may invite only STEM speakers. And it absolutely means that a university, which is a government university, a public university, may invite speakers with whose views the university agrees. But if you outsource that function to student organizations or to outside groups, then you have to be a neutral arbiter.
Let's bring in a call now. David is joining us from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you. Yes, one comment real quick before my question. I think many students go to universities and colleges based on basketball and football, so maybe they ought to look at what their stance is on this freedom of speech stuff before they choose their colleges and universities. But I guess my general question is, it's called Bill of Rights, First Amendment, Second Amendment. It's not Bill of Choices or Bill of Options. I guess I'm just very confused why there seems to be so many lawsuits when, to me, it's very clear. Bill of Rights is pretty clear. I don't know why people are contesting it today.
David, thanks for the call. Why do we see so much litigation around speech? Or do we?
Well, we do see a fair amount of litigation. I think that has more to do with the fact that people have become more litigious and more likely to use litigation as a mechanism to achieve a goal that they want than it does with any change in attitudes about free speech. There's polling data about freedom of expression, and contrary to what some people have claimed, over time that polling data shows no significant change and consistently very, very high levels of support for free speech rights. The more educated, the more college-educated people are, the more they tend to support free speech rights. Students exiting college tend to have higher levels of support for free speech rights than they had coming in. So in all those ways, you know, the narrative that colleges are teaching students to not respect free speech rights is just wrong. I do have to take issue with one thing the caller said, which is the Bill of Rights is not at all clear. What free speech rights require is a very complicated question, to which there is no easy answer whatsoever. No one thinks, for example, that free speech rights means you can say whatever you want, whenever you want. No one thinks that the right of free speech means you can engage in blackmail or treason or fraud or theft of intellectual property, right? So we start from the very beginning by recognizing there are categories of bad speech that the government is allowed to regulate. Then we turn to speech that is not in one of those categories. We have very complicated rules that the courts have developed over time for how and when the government may engage in regulation. So I wish there were simple answers, but keep in mind the First Amendment gives us a guaranteed right of free speech that is literally a few words long. And that's just not enough detail to answer all the myriad issues that arise in the course of operating something like a university.
So when you talk about bad speech or offensive speech, has our sensitivity to offensive speech, has that increased in any way over decades?
No, it's decreased. Over the entire 20th century, initially, governments were empowered to ban any speech that people found offensive. And then slowly over time, the courts have pushed back on that and said, no, being offensive is not a good enough reason to ban speech. And that didn't really become clearly true until approximately the 1960s. It was the Warren Court that said, no, just because your town doesn't like dirty pictures or communist speech or atheists or whatever it is, that's not a legitimate reason to ban that speech. So actually, this idea that we have a right to engage in offending each other, that's the modern phenomenon. And today we're working out the boundaries of that right. I should point out, though, that when I talk about categories of bad speech, offensive is not one of those categories. That is, it is not the case that the government may regulate speech simply because it is offensive. It is the case that the government may regulate speech if it is threatening or disruptive or would interfere with the mission of an institution or is inappropriate to its setting. And those are the kinds of questions that raise serious issues and the kinds of issues that become lawsuits. I know people use offensive as shorthand
sure.
for all the rest of this, but it's sloppy because no one who is seriously involved in these issues thinks that it's legitimate to ban speech or an activity just on the grounds that, quote, it's offensive, end quote.
Talking with Howard Schwaber, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the First Amendment and free speech on college campuses. Howard, another Wisconsin college made news this week when a racial slur was written on the door of a student. The campus has condemned the remark and is investigating. Are we seeing a rise in hate speech on campus? How do we qualify hate speech?
We are seeing a rise in hate speech, although that is a difficult term to specifically quantify, as you say. But we're seeing a rise in specific kinds of incidents, most notably in distribution of materials and graffiti and public displays promoting white nationalism, overt racism, and various forms of fascism or neo-fascism. That is extreme right-wing promotion of hatred. The reasons we're seeing this are complicated. You know, we go back to the idea of the march in Charlottesville, the University of Virginia. It is unthinkable in an earlier era that people would overtly identify themselves as Nazis and march through a campus, except that it's not, right? Because there was the march in Skokie back in the 1970s. So we are seeing a rise in incidents on campus, but what happens on campus reflects the larger society. And the incidence of hate speech, the incidence of racial and ethnic tensions, the degree to which being bigoted in public is considered socially respectable, that varies over time. And in periods where the larger society sees a rise in that kind of expression, campuses will also see a rise in that kind of expression. Let me say that the act of writing a racial slur on someone's door is clearly not First Amendment protected. There's sort of multiple reasons. One is that door is their property, so it's trespass. A second is, it seems to me, unquestionable that's a threat. It's very hard to imagine how you could interpret that as anything other than a statement, you're not welcome here, and if you stay, more bad things will happen to you. And in fact, there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says, for example, a burning cross is always a threat, and therefore is never a protected speech. It's a case called Virginia versus Black. So in the same way that, you know, we can say that college administrators are sometimes pushing the boundaries of restricting speech, there's no question that students and outsiders coming into college campuses are absolutely pushing the boundaries of permitted speech.
So as we wrap up here, what are you keeping an eye on as you study free speech, as you watch campuses around the country and the courts?
Well, there are two things I'm really watching. One is it's long past time for the courts, and the Supreme Court in particular, to give some clear answers of how free speech principles apply on college campuses. There have been a number of cases, historically, as you'd imagine, having to do with those issues, but there have never been clear answers. And college campuses are uniquely complex and difficult contexts for free speech issues. So that's one thing I'm looking for. The most disturbing trend that I'm seeing in the last couple of years is the rise of legislation that I consider to be problematic from a free speech perspective. And the student whom you quoted raised the point. These so-called free speech laws often are written with good intentions, perhaps, in a way that they're most likely to chill genuine protest. If you can be suspended merely for being accused of engaging in disruption, or if you can be suspended because you've engaged in disruption, that's going to make you be very careful about whether you engage in free speech, because disruption is a very difficult term to define.
Howard, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Howard Schwaber is a political science professor at UW-Madison, written several books, including one on the First Amendment. Coming up, we look at millennials and trends in migration. Stay with us. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network.